Okay, and eventually they pushed their way into the seminar room, turned off the video projector, and threw baking flour on me. So this was their idea of freedom of expression. Yeah. So in any case, you asked, why is there an LGB alliance, not an LGBTQ plus alliance? Okay, well, I already mentioned there was some doubts about why LGB and T merged in the late 90s, early 2000s. If you could tell me when the referendum was on ending Q plus, I was certainly never consulted. So people use this term as though it comes from some stone tablets, but it's been entirely invented. My response would be that T is different and Q and plus have no meaning. So I'm quite happy to stick with LGB. And if you look at LGBT organizations today, in chapter 8 of my book, I've described them as capital T, small L, small G, small B. So their priority is transgender rights, and they permit no dissent. So lesbian women who object to male genitals in changing rooms are told they are transphobic and they have a problem. So even when there's a conflict between their constituents, they prioritize transgender over lesbian, for example. So that's what LGB Alliance was really founded in response to the change in the Stonewall organization in the UK, which was founded in 1989 as an LGB organization. And that remained its the focus of its campaigning. It did not work on transgender issues until 2015, when it decided to take them on and prioritize them. And in the event of any conflict, transgender would prevail. And that's what the founders of LGB Alliance, two lesbian women, objected to.
I'm wondering, Robert Wintemute, what your thoughts are on the practical consequences of the UK Supreme Court's ruling in this case last week. And a kind of a related question, but it's distinct. I mean, people can see this ruling as having been, it was unanimous, being, well-founded in law and based on good faith arguments that will be implemented in a good faith manner in the United Kingdom and will be watched and observed elsewhere around the world and perhaps implemented or applied in a good faith fashion in the Netherlands or France or Canada or wherever. But in places like the United States, LGBTQ plus rights, same sex marriage, and all these other things are under, affirming, gender affirming health care and all the rest of it. These are totally distinct issues, not totally distinct, but different. That these kinds of rights and issues, rights and areas are under assault by people who are bigots. Bigots and racists and troglodytes and cultural warriors and people who are really profoundly right wing. And so this is a bit of a conundrum, isn't it? That
It is.
one can make good faith arguments and try to advance society in ways that are just and smart and sensible and practical and equitable. But in the United States, diversity, equity, and inclusiveness is verboten, and transgender people are under assault. And so, what are your
Okay,
thoughts on
well,
this?
I've got some thoughts. I'll first in chapter 8, I talk about trying to build a middle political space, because at the moment the situation is extremely polarized, especially in the US, where you have blue states and red states. And basically, either you're 100% pro-LGBT and agree with all transgender demands, or you're anti-LGBT. And there isn't a space to be pro-LGB and mostly pro-T, but have some concerns about some transgender demands. So that's what I'm arguing for. In relation to that, I have chapter 4 on called Common Ground, issues where I would say all reasonable people agree, such as no violence or against or harassment of or discrimination against transgender people, which is what the UK Supreme Court emphasized on Wednesday in its judgment. So the issues that are cause controversy are change of legal sex, should it be allowed, how easy should it be, Chapter 5. If change of legal sex is allowed, should there be exceptions to protect women-only spaces, sports, etc. And Chapter 7, should adolescent children and adolescents be protected from medical treatment that might make permanent changes to their bodies? Now, that will be the subject of a US Supreme Court judgment in late June in a case about a law in Tennessee that prohibits medical treatment of minors for gender dysphoria. I think it's quite likely that the majority of the court will uphold the law. There are similar laws in 23 other states. And by the way, the province of Alberta has recently introduced similar restrictions.
Restrictions on the ability of young people, adolescents, to receive gender-affirming care.
Well, that's what one side calls it, gender-affirming care. Others would say, no, these are permanent changes to a child's body at a time when they're not able to consent. I mean, what I discuss in Chapter 7 of my book is the UK law, which does not allow a child to buy a cigarette or a bottle of beer before they're 18. They cannot have a tattoo. They cannot have a Botox injection. But until some changes last year, they could be prescribed puberty blockers. That's another debate about whether children should be left alone, and if they want medical treatment, they should get it as adults, 18 or over, or whether they should be rushed into it from the moment they say they identify as a person of the opposite sex. So that's another debate. And that's where you have the red states passing laws to prohibit this treatment and the blue states allowing it. And the thinking in the US is that the red states are evil and all ideas coming from a red Republican-controlled state must be bad.
Because they're fundamentally based on Christian precepts, and they're culture war oriented as opposed to science oriented. In fact, they may be actually anti-science. You know, whereas the folks who are arguing in the blue states for gender affirming care, for the sake of the argument, that based on science, what you've just alluded to is very compelling, that kids who are, geez, when you're 18 or 19 years old, your brain is still reorienting itself. You're legally entitled to do whatever you want when you're 18 years old in theory, but your brain is still totally restructuring itself normally.
Well, some people say it should be postponed till 25 or so for that reason, but
So it's this conflict between coming to the conclusion based strictly on science and human rights versus coming to the conclusion based on your religious points of view and your political
well,
points of view.
I think both sides argue they have science on their side. What the science showed before a so-called gender-affirming treatment was introduced, actually, it was created in the Netherlands and exported to other countries, what gender-affirming treatment for minors. Before that, what they found is that most children and adolescents who identified as person of the opposite sex changed their minds and were able to accept their bodies and did not seek medical treatment as adults. And the common situation is you have a girl who says she's a boy and then changes her mind, says, no, I am a girl. In fact, I'm a lesbian woman. Or boy says he's a girl. Later, he's a happy gay male adult. And so this is where you get major conflict between LGB and T, because you have lesbian and gay adults saying, I remember my childhood. I was a masculine girl. I was a feminine boy. Today I'd be sent to a clinic for medical treatment. Thank God it didn't exist when I was growing up. I was left alone. So that's a huge debate there. But the states that are trying to protect children are the red states, and not for religious reasons, simply to allow them to grow up with their bodies intact. And the states that are trying to protect women's sports are the red states, not the blue states. So I found myself in a very awkward position.
But based on human rights, or but not, you don't think that the red states are coming to these conclusions because it's part of their culture wars, because they're fundamentally, I'm not sure what the correct term is, but they're unreconstructed conservatives.
Well, but I mean, there's this view that if somebody has one single political view you disagree with, then therefore they're wrong on everything. So, and I think that's the way Republicans tend to be viewed in the U.S. Now, I want to mention the case that puts me in an awkward situation, which is the ongoing case about track and field, high school track and field in Connecticut, where two male to female transgender persons were allowed to compete against girls and won a lot of races. And some of these girls thought this was very unfair, and they have gone to court. And so this case is still pending. And which organizations are supporting which side? The American Civil Liberties Union, very pro-LGB organization, is supporting the transgender athletes. And the Alliance Defending Freedom, a Christian rights organization, is supporting the girls. And I agree with the Alliance Defending Freedom. They have the right side of the case. This is fundamentally unfair. And I think this is a particular example of what I might call progressive extremism. So the progressive view is trans women are women in all circumstances, no exceptions, and that includes sports. And the majority of people in the US disagree with this, and in Canada, and in the UK, and around the world. They can see the obvious unfairness. So I call this a political gift from progressives to conservatives. It gives them a wedge issue. And it helped elect Donald Trump. One of his most successful TV adverts referred to transgender participants in women's sports and ended with Kamala Harris is for they, them, Donald Trump is for you. So this refusal to accept any compromise is actually plays into the hands of conservative political movements. So that's my assessment of it. So I said we're trying to build a middle political space. In chapter 8, I comment on Judith Butler's recent book, Who's Afraid of Gender? And she takes the position that there's a global war between gender and anti-gender. So either you're on the side of Judith Butler and you accept all transgender demands, or you're on the side of the Vatican and you're a racist. And so I reject this, and in my book I say, well, no, you can choose your own package of political positions, and because you don't think there should be transgender participants in women's sports, doesn't mean you're against abortion rights or you're a racist. So anyways, that's the middle political space. Now, what does this mean in practice? Chapters 5, 6, 7. Well, 7 I've already talked about. I think children should be protected from medical treatment before they're 18. And chapters 5 and 6, I have a what will be a controversial conclusion about changing legal sex. I actually think it was a mistake from day one. 1972, Sweden appears to have been the first country in Europe to allow change of legal sex. And what I argue is that there was a fork in the road. You had a transgender person appealing to the government and saying, my appearance doesn't match my legal documents. It says sex male, and I've done my best to appear to be a woman. And out of human sympathy, One response was, yes, we need to change your legal documents. But another one would have been, no, we can't change your legal documents because your biological sex is male and will remain male and will never change. However, we will protect you against any kind of violence, harassment, or discrimination. And my explanation is that anti-discrimination law was in its infancy in the early 1970s. And the other route was taken, more and more countries followed, then it became a judgment of the European Court of Human Rights, etc. And this has led to all the complications you've seen today. So our argument in Chapter 5 is that I would say the better option is just not to allow change of legal sex, but instead to protect transgender people. And in Chapter 6, I argue, if the change of legal sex is allowed, it has to be subject to exceptions. I discuss those exceptions. But at the end of Chapter 6, I asked myself, what is the point of changing legal sex? Because when your legal sex and your birth sex do not matter, the certificate makes no difference. It only gives psychological satisfaction to the person holding it. And when your birth sex does matter, the legal sex doesn't count. The certificate doesn't count, as we saw on Wednesday in the UK Supreme Court. So it just made me question the value of these certificates. So there are going to be strong reactions to this book. I'd say the majority of people will agree with my arguments, but the progressive minority will hate it.
It's a complicated area of human rights and intellectual endeavor, isn't it, Robert?
Oh, it is, but...
And it's fascinating at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's hazardous. I would imagine it is as hazardous as being a university academic defending the rights of Palestinians and referring to Israel as a settler, colonial, genocidal, apartheid state, nowhere more so than on a university campus where you can get dismissed. And I would imagine that taking the positions that you take and pursuing the academic thinking that you pursue is... It's academically, professionally, perhaps even personally hazardous. Thoughts on this?
Yes. Let me start by saying that I've realized that my specialty within human rights law is conflicts of human rights. I started with LGB versus Christian. I gave a lecture at the University of Toronto in 2002, and that's led to lots of cases in the courts. And the need to draw lines. When can Christian-owned businesses discriminate against same-sex couples, etc.? When can a Christian marriage registrar working for a local government refuse to serve a same-sex couple? So that's how I really got into the field. And then I visited the occupied West Bank in 2009 and was very shocked by what I saw. Started working on Israel-Palestine. And then I was drawn into the transgender versus women debate. And I've completed this book, which is coming out at the end of May. But I'm planning to return to Israel-Palestine. That's my next project. And there was something I thought of including in the last chapter of the transgender rights versus women's rights book. In the end, I left it out, but I can just sketch it out here. What I found interesting was four combinations of position, political positions. So the progressive position is pro-transgenders, pro-Palestinian. And so the students at McGill, they invaded and tried to shut down my talk on transgender issues because they disagreed with me. But they would love what I say about Palestinian rights. Okay, and then there's another position, which I would call progressive except Palestine. And so these are the pro-transgender, pro-Israel combination. And then there's the generally conservative position, which is gender critical and pro-Israel. So a lot of the conservative people who will like my book, Transgender Rights Versus Women's Rights, will strongly disagree about Israel-Palestine. And I suppose I would like to call my combination of positions the principled position, emphasizing the rights of others. So the rights that have been neglected in these two debates are the rights of women and the rights of Palestinians. I've received emails calling me a Nazi in that context. And then after becoming a trustee of LGB Alliance, I attended the first conference of LGB Alliance at the Queen Elizabeth Conference Centre across from Westminster Abbey in London. And the conference went ahead very successfully inside the building. Outside, there were protesters, and there's a video of them chanting, "Nazi scum off our streets." So I'm a double Nazi for defending the rights of women and defending the rights of Palestinians.
Robert Wintermute is a professor of human rights law at King's College London. His book, Transgender Rights Versus Women's Rights, From Conflict to Coexistence, will be published by Polity at the end of May. We'll link to Polity and post the full video of our conversation with Robert Wintermute at greenplanetmonitor.net. Should anyone out there wish to comment on my conversation with Robert Wintermute or respond in an interview of their own, shoot us an email note, dave@greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Eggs are among nature's most elegant creations, but they're not easy to make. This American robin will lay one egg per day for 3 to 4 days. To make her eggs, the female robin has to use a great deal of calcium. But she can't just pour herself a nice big glass of milk. She has to find her calcium in nature. And it can be tough to find enough. But we can help. During the nesting season, we can give the birds that visit our homes some of that crucial calcium. Start off by putting calcium-enriched seed and suet in your bird feeders. For the many species that don't eat seed or suet, like robins, you can give them leftover chicken eggshells instead. Rinse the shells off in the sink, spread them out on a cookie sheet, and bake them in the oven at about 250 degrees for 10 minutes. You just want the shells to dry, not brown. When you're done, crush them up. Crushed eggshells can be mixed with birdseed and set out in a feeding tray or scattered right on the open ground. And remember, always wash your hands after handling raw eggs. BirdNote gives you the sounds of birds every day. And you can get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at BirdNote Radio.
Hi, this is Mick Ed, and you're listening to The Noise of Carpet on CJSF 90.1 FM and CJSF.ca.
Beautiful. Thanks, Mick.
That is right.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. That is right. Thank you.